Accession number 13253, Jim Forrest, Reel 1.
Jim Forrest, Reel 1. So if I could ask you then, Jim, you know, about your background, whereabouts you were born and brought up, mm-hmm. and the sort of family life you had.
I was born on the 2nd of November, 1941, in Salt Lake City, Utah, Latter-day Saints Hospital. It was Mormon. This, you know, the city is the headquarters of the Mormons. My parents had come there because, particularly my father's work in the Communist Party. He was interested in being someplace out west, and they had an opening for a regional organizer in Salt Lake City, working in Utah and beyond, I think, but especially in Utah. My mother was a social worker, and she probably had some sort of a job there doing that. I'm not sure. Mother talks less about her background than my father did. I get less stories from her. She might have also been working for running the little Communist Party bookshop that they had, was the Jefferson bookshop, I remember the name of. I have no memory of Salt Lake City. We were, I don't know how long they were there, probably quite some time before I was born, perhaps a year or two. I suppose I was a few months old, 5 months old when I left. So I was a red diaper baby, you see. What was this called, a red diaper baby? And that, I think, has had enormous influence on my life. Growing up with communist parents, my father stayed in the Communist Party for the rest of his life. My mother left in the 50s. But when I look at my life and things that influenced me, I'm sure that in both positive and negative ways, this had quite some influence. We lived in a variety of places. My first memories are in Denver. I must have been about 4 years old. And in Colorado. I can remember going up into the mountains on a picnic or something like that. I can remember the flowers on the side of the Rocky Mountains, a spring day, the beautiful, brilliant blue air, and yellow and red flowers moving in the air, and long stems. That's all very vivid. I can remember an automobile accident in Denver. These are early memories. I can remember thinking there was glass on the street and that the automobile engine must be made out of glass. I somehow assumed. I was quite surprised that an engine could be made out of glass. I was quite surprised later on when I discovered it wasn't. It was so clear to me. When I was about five, or just coming to five, I think, my parents were divorced, or at least separated, and the divorce must have followed sometime later. By that time, my father was in the Army, serving someplace in the Pacific, I think in Hawaii, the Signal Corps, Army Signal Corps. We were living in some kind of Army government housing. I have no memory of the war, really, until I can just sort of remember a few radio broadcasts, the voice of President Truman, perhaps the end of the war. Something very, very mysterious to me. I think to all children, I don't quite understand what that's all about. Of course, there's no television. Didn't see any films of it. Moved with my mother and my younger brother to New Jersey, where she had grown up. Now, I should say just a bit about my parents, because they're quite an interesting and contrasting pair. My mother came from a very well-to-do family of principally of Dutch descent, who'd come over originally in the early 1600s to New Amsterdam. So it went way back, and she'd grown up with servants and in a rather well-to-do way. And it ended up in Smith College, where she went through her conversion to radical causes, as did so many students at that time. My father, on the other hand, was born in Massachusetts in extreme poverty, in Boston. His mother was an Irish immigrant, Rose McMurray, although he didn't know the name of his mother until many years later when he was in his 20s, I suppose. He was able to find that out by persistent efforts. It wasn't easy to get this kind of information in those days, sealed records. But when you read Charles Dickens's, particularly Oliver Twist, you get a very, he identified very much with Oliver Twist and with Dickens' writings, and that was his childhood in a metaphorical sense. Living in tenements, growing up with seeing his mother very rarely and having no idea who his father was. And then his mother apparently committing suicide when he was about five. So it was a very wretched start in life. He was lucky, though, that his social worker was somebody who had, was very dedicated to her work. And when he came into state care, he was one of the lucky beneficiaries of a program of putting kids into homes instead of institutions. Ended up in a farming, small light industry village someplace in the western part of the state. And among a succession of children in care that came through the house, he managed, he really campaigned for it, to be somebody whom they would adopt. And they did finally adopt him. He was the one person in care that the family actually took into the family in that sense. But I think that still it was, he never felt fully a member of the family. I don't think, because he at some point broke the relations with those people and never restored them for the rest of his life. Never celebrated his birthday, although he knew it, you see. So there's a lot of pain there. He, to make a long story short, is such an interesting life in its own right, so I'll just go through the Reader's Digest version. As I say, he ended up becoming a tree surgeon as a young man. He was able to get an apprenticeship in that and did very well with it. Worked on a very large estate, millionaire's estate, so he got a vivid glimpse of life on the other side of the wall. I was on Long Island someplace, came down to New York City at some point, and discovered the Communist Party and more or less instantly joined it. They saw that he had a certain gift. He was a very bright man. In fact, that he had been offered, a high school student, a scholarship to Harvard. Couldn't take it because he couldn't afford. I mean, even though they paid for everything, they didn't pay for him to live in Cambridge, you see, and he couldn't live there. No way. So, never went to college. But he could have gone to one of the best.
Well, it's interesting, you know, hearing about your parents, because obviously this must have been an important influence on you. Now, how about you as you were growing up? How about your education?
Well, as I was growing up in New Jersey, I went to a normal... Well, I suppose all schools seem normal to children, don't they? Perhaps it wasn't altogether normal, because there were black and white students in a fairly good mixture, you see. Probably in many schools that wouldn't be the case at that time. But certainly that was true. I was living in a largely black neighborhood. My mother had chosen to live in such a neighborhood. She was a psychiatric social worker, and some miles away the hospital was located, and she'd gotten a house in this neighborhood. So in that sense, the school and the neighborhood were somewhat exceptional places for a white kid to be growing up in. But didn't seem so to me, of course. It just seemed absolutely, this is home. Now I look back and I say probably it would be regarded as a, not our house, but what was the term sociologists might use? A rural slum. Outhouses. Houses just held together, you know, by a few nails and dirt roads. But wonderful people living inside of them. The people I think back on with the greatest gratitude. Then I went to the high school in the town. By that time, I had a well-established interest in journalism, which had somehow been almost in my blood. Just loved pages, books, type, the smell of ink, to go into the newspaper, the town newspaper, and watch the typographer setting type, selling newspapers on the street, delivering newspapers to people's homes, and this sort of thing.
Were you becoming interested in the sort of outside world at that time, Jim, you know, when you were in high school and above?
Well, I can certainly remember them. I mean, probably the outside world poked into my life more than it would have poked into many kids' lives. I mean, my father was in prison for a time in the 50s under the Smith Act arrests, a conspiracy to advocate the overthrow of the United States government by force and violence, pretty impressive charge. Needless to say, this was major news in America whenever these arrests occurred. The FBI was quite thick around us for us at the time. My mother was convinced she would lose her job, that we would be in absolute destitution. We never bought a car because she didn't want to become dependent on something she might not be able to have in the future. We lived a life in which we felt vaguely, if not very vividly, under siege. We were certainly aware, my brother and I, of the Rosenberg case. I can remember my mother reading the letters that the parents in prison in Sing Sing had written to their children, and we had a strong sense of identification with these children. I certainly did. And when they were executed, I can remember weeping with my mother. Still feel that. It's kind of ritual execution. I'm sure that had a big influence on me, too. Another factor, I suppose, probably around the same time was going up to New York City and seeing the play The Diary of Anne Frank. My mother took us to see plays from time to time, usually very light things, musicals, Pajama Game, King and I, etc. But that play certainly brought World War II home to me in a particular way, as it has to so many others. Yeah, so those were some of the ways that we felt the world. And I think I was some slightly aware of racism, not a lot. My mother wasn't indoctrinating us or anything. We didn't see my father very often, and when we did, he wasn't delivering any big messages to us. I know we had to hide. The time came when this newspaper my mother got, the Daily Worker, had to be put away into drawers, and eventually burned with the fall leaves. We wouldn't throw it out with the rest of the garbage. There was a time earlier on when my mother felt much less frightened by what was going on in the world, and she would go around door to door selling subscriptions to that newspaper, and I can remember going with her to do that. But I think, like any mother, practically any mother, when she saw that there was a threat to the family, to the children, then she pulled back, and I'm not sure whether her resignation from the Communist Party was simply prudential or had to do with the eventual disillusionment that she felt that might have come later with the Hungarian uprising, things like that. You know, but certainly when we were small, we had parents who very much believed that the Soviet Union was some kind of a semi-paradise.
Jumping on now, you went into the Navy. What sort of stage of your life would that have been, and why did you go into the Navy?
Well, I think probably for the reason that I would assume that most people go into the Navy. If there's not a war on and there's no enormous imperative to join simply to defend the country, I can remember looking at the posters and brochures and thinking, now that looks like a lot of fun. That looks like I'd have a chance to get out into the world, see things, go places. And in a way, the military provides a kind of some of the rewards of a parental situation and a great deal of freedom at the same time. You get a place to live, you get your clothing, you get your medical care, et cetera, et cetera. It's quite a package. And I was desperate to get out. I had dropped out of high school because I was simply in a rush to live, passionately eager to get out of the classroom and be on the other side of the wall, you know, to be out there where people were actually living, doing things. So I had been quite a spectacular student, and then the whole thing became quite dead to me. Now, I suppose it also had to do with the frustrations that the family was going through at the time. There probably were more darker side to it than I was consciously aware of. I was living at that time in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, actually. I was going to Hollywood High School with my father. And I didn't realize at the time how very unhappy his marriage to his second wife was. I didn't realize that he was in rather bad health himself. You know, kids can miss an awful lot at that age. And teenage kids are not famous for noticing what's going on in their parents' lives. So after having spent all the time I could during holidays, you know, camping, working, painting signs, getting odd jobs, going into the mountains, taking various courses at the university and doing all sorts of things, I just got to a point where I just couldn't stand it anymore, this whole the school business. And the Navy seemed like a wonderful thing to do. And I suppose I'd gone back east at Christmas time, and I didn't return to Los Angeles. I was at my mother's house, and I was trying to think what to do. I don't want to go back to school. I want to get out in the world. My mother, of course, was very worried about me and what was going to happen to me. You could imagine. My very romantic ideas about just going off, you know, Jack London style or something like that. So I suppose when I came up with the idea of joining the Navy, it was probably a relief to her. At least I'd be in a structure of some kind, you see. So there was no particular objections to that.
What date would it
have been? I was 17.
So that would have been 58?
59. Spring of 59. And my birthday would have been the previous November. And I was 17, therefore I had to have parental permission. If I was 18, I could have done it on my own.
So how did you settle in? You
I was going to be a journalist, by the way. They promised that I could be a journalist, and this was also part of the thing. You know, I talked to the recruiting agent, and he said that, what are you interested in? I'm interested in journalism. Oh, well, then you can be a journalist, even though I was a high school dropout. Well, you know how these guys promise more frequently than is actually delivered. When I got into boot camp, it turned out that you had to be 21 years old in order to be a journalist. I don't know if that's true or not. This is just what they told me at the time. They might have told me that any number of things. You never know in those situations what the truth is. I took it to be the truth. In any event, they said, now you have to choose something else. So I looked on the spot through all kinds of things that I could be trained to be, and I decided, well, I enjoy natural science. I enjoy the out-of-doors. I'll be an aerographer's mate, which means a meteorologist. I was sent after leaving boot camp to the Navy Weather School, and graduating first in my class, they decided I ought to go to the Weather Bureau in Washington, D.C., and that's where I went. So I spent the rest of my time in the Navy at the Weather Bureau in Washington, the little Navy unit that, among other things, did a twice-a-day live television broadcast to the War Room of the Pentagon to give a Northern Hemisphere weather report and to answer questions that were put by those in the war room on anything that was of interest to them at that moment. Needless to say, that gave us quite some connection to the Cuba invasion. We were the people who were providing the weather backup for the invasion of Cuba. Yeah. I was the captain's aide at that point. I was working in the front office in a very cushy and responsible job. They knew, of course, that I came from a communist family. There had been some form or other along the way. I had no security clearance at all as a result. I was, you know, permitted to look at nothing more important than paper clips officially. And I can remember, well, they trusted me, and rightly so. I was very trustworthy. I actually had the job sometimes of producing top secret papers and collating them and stapling them together and things of this kind, on the gentleman's agreement that I wouldn't read them. And indeed I didn't. No, absolutely not. Putting top secret stamps on papers and not reading them. I have no idea what the subject was. You know, that was... incidentally, all this coincided with my religious awakening. And so that on the one hand there was my Navy work, on the other hand there was my religious life. And
well, were you interested in Cuba, though? You know, the fact that
I had no particular interest in Cuba as such. I probably wouldn't have found it. Well, I was very interested in geography. I suppose I could have found it on the map without too much difficulty, but I certainly didn't mean anything to me. I had no sense of it being a just or unjust society or why. There were interesting articles in Life magazine, so I suppose that I must have seen those and had some idea what Castro was doing, and the initial presentation, as I recall, in Life magazine of Castro was rather more positive than negative. In the beginning, the Americans had were looking at... now that you asked the question, I suppose I probably was faintly aware that there had been a revolution that had been brought on by corruption from the former government, and that it had been an awful place for most people, and very corrupt gambling and prostitution and all that. But it certainly wasn't something on my mind. I wasn't sitting around thinking, how do I protest this, or what do I do to support Castro, or anything like that. The political event at that time that was most important to me was the election and inauguration of John Kennedy, you see, which had preceded the Cuban invasion by just a few months. I was in Washington when he was inaugurated, and I can remember watching him on television a couple of miles away from the Capitol building in the apartment where I was staying, giving his inauguration speech and tears running down my face. Don't ask what you can get, think what you can give, basic message. That absolutely rang true to me, both as an American and as a Christian. So I was very proud that the person of such values was the President of the United States. Proud to be in the Navy. I more and more realized as a Christian that actually this probably wasn't the right place to be, but being there and doing, I thought the work that I was doing was, if not a great help to humanity, wasn't doing very much harm and sometimes some good. And I didn't have anything to do with guns or anything of that kind. So I didn't feel wretched about being in the Navy, not at all. I was simply, but I knew I was getting clear to me that when the time came to re-enlist that I wouldn't, because, not because of any protest as such, but simply because there were things that I wanted to do that were more connected with my religious values. I was working in my spare time at a home for emotionally disturbed children in Washington, run by the Episcopal Diocese, and that seemed to me much more appropriate kind of activity.
So getting on to your first sort of protest, this would have been about Cuba.
Yes. I'm thinking. Well, that hit me like lightning, you see. It wasn't clear to me until it happened that I was sort of aware there was a lot of weather stuff being done about things in that part of the Caribbean. But it didn't make any political connections. I wasn't thinking about what is all this for. Naturally, they don't tell you what it's for. I wasn't in the know on any of those things. Probably some of these top secret papers that I was stamping. I can remember a whole bunch of Latin American military brass coming up to the office around that time. Generals and colonels with 10,000 pounds of gold drapings all over them, you know the stuff, and having all these hats hanging on the racks and all these fancy military high general type things all over the place, and it was a bit of a comic opera out of the Marx Brothers as far as I was concerned, and bringing them their coffee, and they're a rather sinister bunch, I thought, but I wasn't, again, thinking about it politically, just that I was awfully glad that I didn't have to spend a lot of time with these people. I wouldn't want to be in their household. But when I saw in the Washington Post that the United States had actually engineered this invasion, I must say that it hit me with in a way that very few political events have hit me in my life. I felt this grief, just a kind of awful grief that we would, first of all, do something like that and then lie about it. And then finally, only because the New York Times had actually known beforehand about this and was determined to finally publish the truth about it, that the President of the United States felt that there was no alternative but to square with the American public, which is something presidents don't very often do. It's to John Kennedy's credit that he felt he had no alternative, but whatever it was, he did, in fact, take responsibility and probably began a process of major changes, which, if he had lived longer, might have added up to something. I knew nothing about all that stuff, of course. Just this feeling of... I would say more than anything, sadness. Deep, deep, deep sadness.
So did you do anything about that? You know, how did you make this manifest?
Well, in the Post, I saw an article, a very short piece, someplace buried, and certainly wasn't on page one, that a group of pacifists were down in front of one of the CIA buildings in Washington, D.C., fasting and vigiling and praying. And that just seemed the right thing to do. I think I sensed that there was something penitential about it. And I must say, probably by this time, I'd have to think about this, but I think I would have, if anybody had asked me, I would probably say I was a pacifist. You know, I think that my understanding of what Christianity was all about had devolved to a point where it was clear to me that I was a pacifist. I wouldn't have thought of myself very much as a protester. Not at all, in fact. But just as somebody who wanted to do life-supporting things for the rest of my life. And the work with kids was, in my mind at that point, was pretty typical of the kind of things that would be an appropriate vocational focus. But when I saw this group down that was down there, I just thought, well, after work, I'll go down and see if they're still there. And they were. Oh, I don't know how many there were. 15, 20? Dave Dillinger, I think, was one of them, if I recall correctly. I'm not sure. Carl Meyer, I could be absolutely sure of. He was from the Catholic Worker. But Dave Dillinger is a well-known figure in the American peace movement, was at that time. Not somebody I particularly like, but very famous and as a pacifist. Carl Meyer was the son of a congressman who was from the Catholic Worker in Chicago and often wrote for the Catholic Worker newspaper. I was aware of the Catholic Worker. They had it in the parish library at my church in Washington. And I knew about Dorothy Day. I think by that time I'd probably read her autobiography. You know, the founder of the Catholic Worker movement.
Did you wear your uniform?
No. Oh, no. I wouldn't have thought of wearing my uniform because I didn't absolutely had no desire at all to be seen as embarrassing the government as a person in service. It wasn't a protest against my employers or anything like that. It was a very personal sense of identification with the what these groups were trying to say. It seemed, in a very peaceful way, quietly standing in front of the CIA. I think the director of the CIA, Alan Dulles, at the time, sent out coffee, offered coffee to us. I don't know if we took it or not. I don't recall. I think everybody was fasting, so they probably didn't. But I thought it was very nice of him to do that. I must say I was distressed and by the people making kind of typical Cold War shouts at us from cars as they drove by. Why don't you go to Moscow? Or things of this type. But it was all very new to me. I'd never been or imagined being in a protest of any kind, you see. It was very unpremeditated, and I had no idea that it would have any dramatic consequences in my life. I didn't think I was doing anything that I shouldn't be doing. I thought, well, this is my time. I'm in my own civilian clothes. I'm not here to make a big thing about who I am or what I do for a living. Instead of going to the National Gallery, I'm going here. That's all. I often went to the National Gallery. Might have done that day had it not been for this.
So what were the consequences?
Well, you see, they were taking pictures of us with telephoto lenses. I can remember some people with cameras up on the lawn. See, this wasn't the main headquarters of the CIA. This was some building that they had in town, which was a beautiful old mansion with a wide lawn that sort of rolled up to the mansion and a very handsome piece of real estate. Nice part of town, beautiful green trees. Beautiful day to be there, as a matter of fact. I might have come down for 2 or 3 days. I don't remember whether it was one day or whether I did this for several days. I don't recall anymore. Probably a couple of days. Well, then it ended. I think they were going, they went on to something else, these people. And I, probably nothing would have ever more come of it for me, had it not been for me being called into the captain's office, a very irate captain indeed, absolutely in a steam coming out of his ears. What is this about you picketing the CIA or something like that and having some form for me to sign? Answer questions. Immediately I was thrown out of my job in the office and put into the night shift and back room, as far down the ladder as I could be thrown at that moment. I was a third-class petty officer, and I had been getting rave reviews in all of my evaluations and so forth.